This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own personal... Crap. Okay, just kidding. It's not actually brought to you by anything. But it'd be cool if it was sponsored. Anyhow, this podcast is going to be about designing for people. What I'm going to do here is introduce you to the notion of user-centered design process. And it essentially is kind of a gateway to the first, you know, chunk of the class. So the agenda is as follows. We talked last time about how the user is not like me. And so, you know, if we know that that is the case, what are we supposed to do? The user-centered design process has four major components, or five major components: an investigate phase, an ideate phase, a prototype phase, an evaluation phase, and then finally a production phase. What I'll talk to you about today is essentially what the rationale is for the user-centered design process, and then what the role of iteration plays in this process. So just to recap really quickly, when we say that the user is not like me, we mean this in a bunch of different ways. I've listed four on the slide here, but at the very least, they're certainly different in terms of their domain knowledge, what they know about the problem space or the area, right? They're different in terms of their cognitive capacity than you. They may differ in terms of their motor capacity, so particularly if we're designing, of course, accessible interfaces. But anytime we design something, you know, how somebody makes use of it may be very different from how we're thinking about how they're going to use it, right? So when we design mobile apps, often we're designing using an emulator sitting on our desks, whereas they may be using it on their phones. But furthermore, they may be using it on their phones while they're on the train, for example, or on a bus, in which case they only have one hand to manipulate the interface. Or maybe they're walking, and so they need to look up every once in a while. And so their perceptual capacity is also very different. So the mantra is, you know, not only is the user not like you, but actually the mantra is also know your user. Understand the context in which they're going to use your device. Understand what they understand about the tool. Know what they know, right? So spend time to figure this out, right? We need to figure out what they're going to use it for, how they're going to use it, all of these things. And again, the corollary to this is that you are not usually your user. Right? When are you the user of your tool? Well, when you're building some little dinky tool for yourself to use, basically. That's the only time that you are actually the user. Other times, you're basically just a tester, and you're just building stuff for other people, right? So the user-centered design process is an iterative design process that makes use of knowledge through investigation of a domain of work or play to create ideas and prototypes. Prototypes are used for evaluation and to further stimulate investigation and idea and prototype generation. These prototypes and evaluations are used to aid in production. Okay, so I'm just going to dissect that a little bit, right? So some key words here is that it's an iterative design process. So that means that you repeat little bits of it over and over again. And the idea is that we get better each time. Now, the important part here is that nobody's expecting a good design right at the start, right? We are expecting kind of not such great things at the beginning. You know, many ideas perhaps that show some glimmer of hope, but ultimately that iterative process allows us to refine designs and get better as we go. Makes use of knowledge through investigation of a domain. So investigation is a huge part of this. So studying a domain or an area or and people that work in those domains or whatever it may be, and understanding how those people's work plays out, right? The next step is that there are prototypes involved here. So not only do we build prototypes of what our ultimate designs are going to be, so we can actually see, touch, and feel these things, but we also use these to evaluate those designs, right? We test whether they're any good. We give them to people. We have them try little tasks out. And we assess whether or not it's whether it's actually useful. And we use this to stimulate investigation, right? So as we evaluate it, we learn not only more about people, but we learn about those prototypes. And we use that to build and come up with better new ideas, right? And then obviously, these prototypes and evaluations are useful for us later. So why is there a process involved, right? So in some ways, you can think of user-centered design as having kind of like a very formulaic approach to this, right? And it's formulaic only in the sense that there are a set of actions to follow. And the reason why you follow this process is that, you know, for a bunch of reasons. One, it gives you started on a proven track. So we know that this is our attack. So we know that this is something that's going to work. It has worked for many other people. It has worked for many other different kinds of projects. And so we can make use of it here. It prevents designer's block, where you're not really sure what to do, right? So you always can do something. It directs us towards a final product, helps us to stay on schedule and on cost, and it helps us to communicate with other people. So as we build these prototypes, it lets us tell other people, well, this is what I meant. You know, this is the idea that we had when we were coming up with this design. The other big thing here is that it's more reliable than intuition, right? So you may have some gut instinct about how something should be designed, but actually going through the process of testing it out allows you to see whether or not that's actually the case. The process demands that we iterate. And the basic idea here is it's kind of related to agile software engineering approaches, where the idea is that if we iterate on a design, we'll get better. And the other thing is, what you'll see in this process is that it always keeps the users first, right? It always says, what are the users interested in? What are the users like? Are the users going to be able to, you know, complete the tasks that we expect them to complete? That sort of stuff. So this slide here, this next slide here, is actually kind of a diagram of what that user-centered design process looks like. And so if you just kind of take a look at where all these arrows point, so just kind of roughly, it starts from investigate, moves over to ideate, where you come up with ideas, then it goes to prototype, where you're actually kind of like sketching some of these things out and building them out. Then it moves to evaluate, where you're actually testing out that prototype somehow. From evaluate, you can learn a lot of different things. You might learn that, for example, your design is terrible, in which case, well, we got to go back to investigating our users. Or you might learn some other ideas where you're like, oh, maybe we should try that idea out, and it may prompt some more ideation. Or you may just have a very concrete idea of what you might test out or refine further from your existing prototype, in which case you go back to the prototype phase. So going through this process in sort of an iterative way multiple times leads you to kind of a set of prototypes that you think are good enough to help support production in a meaningful way. In your projects that you will do in this class, what you'll find is that we will start from an investigate phase, move through an ideate phase, a prototype phase, an evaluate phase at least once. So each of these phases obviously have a set of goals, right? So the investigate phase, what you're trying to do is learn about your stakeholders, discover what their goals and needs are, how is whatever it is done right now. So perhaps as a running example, we can talk about, library book checkout at a library. How do they do it right now? What is it that they actually want to do? What else has actually been tried? What do we see kind of in the marketplace? Or what have we already tried as a company, right? So your goal here is to generate lots of ideas. In the ideate phase now is to generate lots of ideas, right? And as you generate the ideas, you start to see what the issues and potential solutions might be. Oh, if we did it as a hand scanner thing, like this will work well because people can, you know, move the scanner around depending on, you know, if it's a big book perhaps, or maybe it's something where it's hard to find the barcode or whatever it might be. But on the other hand, you know, if you had something that's a hand scanner, you're going to find that, oh, now we've got to worry about the connection for the hand scanner, right? What if the wire gets loose or whatever it might be, right? So you start to understand what the issues and the potential solutions are. In the prototype phase, the goal is to produce something that's tangible, something that you can actually look, see, feel, and touch, right? And in this way, you're also identifying some of the challenges. And of course, when you actually have something in your hand, you're able to uncover some of the subtle problems that you wouldn't have been able to intuit from earlier. From there, you move up to an evaluate phase, where the purpose is to discover problems when actual real users make use of this thing, assess the progress that you're making, and then also to determine what the next steps are. In the produce phase, you're trying to build the final product, ramp up a marketing support and maintenance and that sort of stuff. Right? So all that stuff is important too. But for the purpose of this class, mainly we'll talk about those first four phases. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go through each of these phases in turn and chat about why we have them, what we're trying to do, and touch on some methods for going about it. Right? So why do we have this investigate phase? Well, the mantra here is you cannot design apart from the world in which your users and your design will live. So what we often see is that the real world is actually very different than the world that we imagine. My favorite example of this is our USB keys and their holders that people used to come up with. So if you're looking at the slide right now, what you'll see on the left side is an HP USB key, 32 gigs. And in fact, this is not exactly the one that I bought, but I bought one that was exactly like this at some point. So it's not exactly this, but it's similar to this. It had the same design feature, I guess. And at the time, I was all stoked because it was 32 gigs, and at the time, most people only carry around 1 gig sticks if they were cool. So what happens with this one is it's cool, it's small, you can put it on your keychain, that's great. A problem that you can probably imagine now that you're looking at this is that the lid is attached to your keys. So in fact, it's very easy for the actual USB key to like become detached essentially, and then you lose that thing. And that's in fact what happened to me. The flip side of this, of course, is if you attach it to the other side, now your keys are staying next to your computer, right? So it's interesting, right? These problems that come up. The other design that you're seeing on the screen right now is one where you basically have this bullet-shaped USB key, and you kind of got to screw it on, right? But there are trade-offs, right? This is between these two designs, right? One is easier to attach to a computer. The other one takes a little bit more time. One is less likely to be lost. One is not, so on and so forth, right? So how do you decide what the best design is? Well, part of the way you would do it is you try to understand who your users are, right? Who's going to actually make use of this USB key? How are they going to actually make use of it? So on and so forth. So some questions that you're trying to address or answer when you're kind of going through an investigation is you want to identify their users, who are the users that are making use of this, who are the stakeholders, and in fact, stakeholders and users are not always the same, okay? So a quick example is if you talk about the PeopleSoft system inside of the university, well, the stakeholders are actually the administrators and the people that actually have the money, right? The users are people like you and me, right? Students, profs, so on and so forth. The admins also make use of it, but in that case, they're not as heavy users as we are, right? What are the requirements of the tool, right? So not only from a functional perspective, but in terms of a usability perspective. How do they actually do these processes right now? How long does it actually take? What do they want? What do they need? You know, what do they think they need, right? And what have they already tried? Is there another solution? Do we actually need to build something? These are things that you're trying to answer all the time, okay, in the investigation phase. So it's a whole bunch of methods to do this, and since I'm going to cover investigation stuff starting in the next lecture, I'll just touch on a couple of these, right? So you can do interviews, you can do focus groups, you know, bring in a group of people and chat with them at the same time. You can also conduct user surveys, where what you do is you send out perhaps a web-based survey or a paper-based survey, so on and so forth. And these are ways to gather information about the current context as it exists today. Moving on to the ideate phase. So as I said, in the ideate phase, your goal is basically to come up with a lot of ideas. And in so doing, you get to see the space of possible solutions and some of the problems that you may encounter. The mantra here is to get good ideas, get lots of ideas. So it's rare that the first idea that you come up with is the best idea, even though you may think it is. It turns out, done studies on this stuff, that actually the best idea comes somewhere down the road, and you have to come up with a lot of them. The worst thing you can do is to go with the first idea that you have, because the reality is you can always come back to this later. If you discover that, in fact, all your other ideas are terrible, you can always come back to this. And in fact, this is quite related to brainstorming, right? So volume is what matters the most here. You want as many different designs, different design possibilities as you can, because as you come up with many ideas, it increases the chance of success by considering a huge volume of ideas in a systematic way. So what I'm showing here is an image of essentially a bunch of sketches that somebody did for a logo. And you can see that actually it's a part of even more logos. And it's actually part of a whole bunch of logos. And what you look at, what you can see is if you dive into this image a little bit, is that you'll see that different areas, the way he's done it is that he's used different areas of the space to basically denote like different like ideas, right? So in this area over here, let's consider if the logo is going to be a globe. Over here, let's consider if it's going to look more like a letter. Over here, let's look at what it looks like if, you know, this guy has three arms or whatever it might be. And so you can see there that he's got a lot of different ideas that he's exploring there. Bunch of different techniques that you can do on this. You can do structured brainstorming, you can do sketching, affinity diagramming, card sorting, personas, role-playing, play-acting. Most of these terms don't mean a lot, and I will get into them in a lecture upcoming. An interesting one that I always think is fun is one called card sorting. So have there been instances where you're looking for something in a hierarchy of menus and you can't find the thing that you're looking for? Well, the problem that is actually happening is that your mental model of how things should be organized is very different from how the designer actually organized kind of that menu hierarchy, right? So one way to address this is to actually have your users do some card sorting for you, right? So what they do is, so for Firefox or for Google Chrome, you would list out every single one of those, you know, features or things that people need to do, whatever it might be, cut, copy, paste, save, new, open, tab, open URL, all of these things. And then what you do is you would have them sort them into what they think are logical categories. And basically you derive from multiple people doing this, you derive essentially some menu scheme that is generally going to fit with how people think about things. And I think even if you take a very simple application such as, you know, Firefox and just take the top level items, I think what you will find is you and your friends are actually going to sort these in very, very different ways. All right, moving on. The prototype phase is essentially about building these things out in cheap and fast ways. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to build them in sort of tangible ways so that both users, stakeholders can react to concrete things rather than just kind of ideas or pictures on the screen, okay? So prototyping and actually having something that's kind of semi-working actually brings a lot of these subtleties and problems to light. And of course, when you're actually building it, working against some of the technical constraints is good, right? Because it reveals that there are these constraints that you may not have seen before or foreseen. So here, what are some of the techniques that we've seen? You can build actually paper prototypes, which is interesting, right? So what you do is actually you build the interface using paper. I'm just going to show you a picture of this in a moment. You can build screenshots, you can build flipbooks, video mock-ups are fantastic. Hyperlink prototypes, so something in PowerPoint or HTML or whatever it might be. Functional prototypes, which is something that you will build in this class. So you actually build something that actually sort of works as a piece of software. So again, we'll get into some of these techniques in a week. The next image I've got here, this is actually one of the first sketches of Twitter, right? So you can actually see in this prototype, or this paper prototype essentially, some of the little bits that they actually imagined to be in Twitter. It doesn't look exactly the same, but some of the functionality is still there, so you get that idea. And so, of course, it's easier to react to this as a paper screenshot, right? One way to think about it. It's easier to react to this than it would be to react to somebody telling you, hey, I'm going to build a system that, you know, you can send 140 characters to and it'll go to all your friends, right? Nobody gets that, right? But this makes a little bit more sense, because it's something that you can see. Some fundamentals for prototypes: you want to be able to build it fast. You want to build on unknowns rather than things that you know very well, right? Never be attached to your prototypes, right? Your prototypes are built to be thrown away. And then finally, you want to build multiple concurrently. If you have lots of prototypes, you can actually compare the pros and cons of each. You can say, this one is definitely going to work better for X, and this one is definitely going to work better for Y. And figuring out why it is those things work better for each of those reasons is going to be useful, because it lets you build something even better at the very end. Evaluate phase, right? Why do we do evaluation? Well, if we do automated testing, like Lint, whatever it might be, it can find bugs, but not usability issues. Usability issues are basically issues that people have when using your tool. So critical piece there, people using your tool. When they have problems, those are usability issues, right? An evaluation is a way to move forward. You test it out with somebody. It tells you what needs to be fixed. It tells you what needs to be added. It tells you what can be removed. And in fact, removing things is a great thing. It simplifies your interface, right? So doing evaluations answers two questions. Did we build the thing right? And did we build the right thing? And those two are actually very different things, right? Building the thing right means you've got the basic idea correct, but you need to tweak it a little bit. if you've got the wrong thing altogether, that means we don't need this thing, or we've just got the wrong basic idea, right? Bunch of evaluation methods, usability testing, laboratory experiments, real-world deployments, heuristic evaluation. Just to give you a quick sense, usability testing involves bringing people into the lab, having them try out your prototype, right? Perhaps comparing it to other versions. Real-world deployment means giving people the tool or the application, having them try it in their lives. Just as a quick exercise, which we will do in class, one thing I want you to do is I want you to take this watch, this digital watch, and imagine if we were going to evaluate this thing, the usability of this thing, not the functional requirements, but the usability of this thing, what are the things that we would test? What would we bring in a user to do? What would we study? What would we evaluate? Right? What are some tasks that we would have them do? As I mentioned earlier, evaluation drives iteration. So if the problem is that it doesn't seem to be useful or appropriate, then that means that we've got the wrong thing. We're building the wrong thing. We need to go back to the investigation phase. If the problem is that the users don't understand what we've built, then we maybe need to return to the ideation phase. Maybe we built the thing incorrectly. It needs some refinement. If the problem is user performance, i.e. they're not performing as quickly some certain tasks we'd like, that means we need to return the prototyping phase. Finally, very briefly, I'll talk about the production phase. So in the production phase, you're basically going from a functional prototype to developing a release candidate. And some of the things that you need to think about are, what's the software architecture? How do you program this? How do you build it? How are we going to move this to manufacturing? What are the help systems that we're going to need to put into place? How do we build the manuals? What is the training that we're going to need? Customer support, marketing, branding, distribution, that sort of stuff. An interesting thing is that actually at Microsoft, if you're a developer, what you will do every year about is you will be placed into the product support team just for a day. And your job will basically be to listen to customer complaints or questions that they have about the product that you're building. This is a great way, if you think about what's going on here, this is a great way of giving you insight about what problems people are actually having with the system that you have built. It also gives you great insight into, okay, what kind of training do we need to provide? What should the manuals actually do? And actually, if we go back to the drawing board, how should we redesign perhaps that feature or that area of the application such that they don't run into those issues? All right, so just to wrap this up really quickly then, we've talked about the user-centered design process. Some quick things to think about. Design starts with understanding your user and should keep your user's interests central. So those should be at the center of your whole design process. It's an iterative process, and what you see is that it's iterative because as you come up with ideas, you may not see all the problems that are coming that they have. And so they're difficult to see in advance, and so you need to go through this process multiple times to actually identify these issues and address them as you go. Designs are rarely perfect. Usually they can be improved, or they are making trade-offs that may not work in certain contexts. All right, so that wraps up this podcast right here.